Well, we can get started. I want to share my screen to show the picture of the 10th Oxherding picture, the one we're discussing this whole month and in particular right now. Here we go. Can everyone see both? Give me a thumbs up if you can see the picture and also the words. Yeah? Great. And did they change when I moved something else on my screen? You can still see it all right? Yeah, great. So to give a little context for this picture here, so this is entering the marketplace with extended hands. This is the last picture in this cycle, in this journey that the ox herder has had that we've been discussing all year. But as a little context, the arc of the journey, the way I see it, is there is this slow, the ox herder begins in the world struggling, slowly finds the path, the spiritual practice, grapples with it, struggles with it, and then reaches what I call, and I think some of the other teachers have called, the top of the mountain. Right, you know, two pictures ago, you know, after going through this struggle, I'll go through the struggle a little bit too. So there's the grappling, there's the making peace, there's the riding the bull home, and there's this process of really coming to a deep spiritual awakening. And I think that peaks in a sense in the eighth picture. And these last two pictures, as we've mentioned a few times in these talks, have been added on afterward. To add them on was, you know, a really conscious choice. And it's really to point out that the journey is not over at the top of the mountain. The ox herder returns back, and in this last picture, entering the marketplace with extended hands, you know, we have this picture of someone who is transformed. You know, Lindell talked a bit about this last week. He's happy. He's generous and loving. He has open hands. And, you know, if we read the words, barefooted and naked of breast. This is a person who is not concerned in that egotistical way about his appearance. I mingle with the people of the world. He's in connection. My clothes are ragged and dust laden, and I am ever blissful. He's not really concerned at this point with the material life and those ways that we can get wrapped up in it. He's ever blissful. I use no magic to extend my life. So there's this implication that it's possible. He's developed enough that he could have turned his attentions to these esoteric means of extending his life, but he's not interested in that. You know, he's free, and free includes maybe an acceptance of death here. Now before me, the dead trees become alive. His view has been totally transformed. So I think that in a way, this part is the toughest and perhaps in some ways the most important challenge presented in these pictures. And the question I want to deal with is, the question and the challenge is, how do we bring our practice back into regular life? How do we go from this dissolving, this picture of no self? How do we take it back into the world? So in our own lives, we may have had experiences that really are this, you know, where you forget yourself, you forget your pursuits, you're dissolved. And, you know, we may have had those experiences, but for many of us, we're talking about, or the analogy here, is to experiences like those experiences we have from practice. You know, have we ever had an experience where we have meditated and we feel something shift in us? Maybe it's not even meditation. Maybe in our regular lives, we had a transformative experience, an interaction perhaps, or just maybe it's an experience with a song or a conversation where someone said something and we felt a deep shift. And once we feel a shift like that, we're presented with an opportunity to integrate whatever has happened into the remainder of our lives, to make it something that affects the way we move through the world thereafter. And that is a challenge, isn't it? For those of us who've ever been on meditation retreats, it's very common at the end of a retreat, after we've spent all this time in internal seclusion, developing these qualities, developing this skill of concentration, of being mindful, we're presented with this talk often toward the end about, okay, now you're going to go out of this, you know, cloistered world where everyone has been silent for the past so many days. And you're going to enter your lives. You're going to drive back from this retreat center or this, you know, this silent retreat we sometimes do at home. We're going to re-enter speech. We're going to re-enter the patterns and the people that are parts of our worlds. And this re-entry, this reintegration is a real challenge. It's maybe the most important part of a retreat, isn't it? Whatever happens during a retreat, how do we bring it? So I want to sit quietly with this question, and I'll leave this picture up for this. For a couple of minutes, I would welcome an inquiry. I'm going to ring one bell at the beginning, just a couple of minutes of silence, and then another bell at the end. And my invitation is to sit with the question, how did he bring this transformation back to the marketplace? How can I bring my own practice more fully into my life? I wanted to share for the remainder of this talk a few reflections on that question. So the first thing that I think of when I think of this return from the top of the mountain to life, is remembrances of going to retreat. I moved to Seattle only in the last 4 years, and a lot of the time when I would go on retreat, I would go in California, somewhere in Northern California, where a lot of my retreats. And there is always this moment when you leave the retreat center and you enter Bay Area traffic, you know, and it would often be the case that I was entering right around a rush hour. And so all of a sudden, you know, like, oh, I'm driving slowly, and I know this because, you know, there's a person kind of tailing me behind me. You know, there are red lights to deal with, green lights, there might be honking, there are confusing intersections where I'm like, oh, well, is this my entrance? Is this my highway? You know, all of a sudden, all this stuff comes back and you have to deal with it. And I was remembering that moment of meeting it, right? And maybe the first few minutes after a retreat are easy. You know, often I have enough of that glow stored from my retreats to, you know, to kind of be okay with all that. All right, you know, I'm a little confused. Okay, maybe I need to speed up a little after this retreat. But it gets progressively more difficult, especially for me as I enter familiar places, you know, as I re-enter my home, as I re-enter my work life, my relationships, all of that, my regular patterns. It's so easy to not to enter those habits and patterns and re-enter the lens with which I previously saw all of that too, to remove the kind of lens or the new way of seeing that came from a retreat. It kind of fades away very naturally. So I wanted to name that as some of, you know, what I experience as this challenge. So to reflect on this question, I also wanted to say, you know, maybe we can start with the changes that happen when we're on the mountain in retreat. Maybe we can start with the changes that have happened to this ox herder. You know, for the ox herder, one of the changes is no self, right? it's this, you know, there is this experience of emptiness where, you know, he has dissolved his ego up on that mountain in that eighth picture. And he's left in this picture, he's preserved it in this way that he has a desire to serve without overly caring about himself, and, you know, in the sense of caring about unnecessary material needs or his own ego. There's also this quality of love that you may remember from retreat or from deep practice. We can get cracked open with loving kindness. You know, it may manifest as a love for nature if we're in a natural environment. It may be that your experience of shift is something that happened on a hike and you had this feeling of connection with nature and love for nature. It could be a love for humanity. It could be love for the people you attended a retreat with or the people in a sangha at a moment when you felt a shift. He's brought that love with him, right? He's entering the marketplace with this quality of being open and connected. Another quality, so we've talked about no self, this dissolving of ego. We talked about love for humanity, love for nature. There's also a certain equanimity here. You know, it doesn't matter that his clothes are ragged and dust laden. You know, you get the sense that this is a person who would talk just as well to, you know, the lowest of the low in this marketplace or the most prominent citizens of the town who've come to attend, who would care just as much about not stepping on a bug as, you know, not offending someone in a position of importance, who may also regard those challenging things and those delightful things that emerge in his experience of the marketplace equally. Both as just experiences, right? That equanimity, being okay with everything. So those are some of the qualities. And next I'll reflect a little on how we might preserve some of those qualities, what the teachings have to say about that. So how do we preserve this no self, this dissolving of self, of ego? So maybe we can't do that exactly. You know, Martine Batchelor reflects that in a sense, when we come back to the world, we can't really be absent of forms, you know, to move through the world. It's beyond us, you know. And, you know, when we first come back from a retreat and we have that dissolved ego, you know, maybe we're a little less reactive and maybe we're a little less in our egos and identities. You know, suppose, you know, a relative comes and says something we find manipulative, right? You know, we might find that thing that they said to be somewhat insignificant in the first moments after the retreat. It would land on the ears of our body, right? If we're really feeling deeply, we're really feeling present, we might notice that, oh, someone said something, it landed on my ears. Maybe it felt uncomfortable. It produced a feeling tone that just wasn't good. And then maybe if there's not much for it to connect with afterward, there isn't much identity, it might just, you know, it might vanish, it might dissipate. But later on, our identities return, our beliefs, our who we are, who, what this person has done to me, you know, all of that comes back. And then that thing that this relative says, it interacts with an identity and the identity feels challenged. You know, it becomes more difficult. We hold on to it. We cling to it. You know, so what can we realistically preserve when our identities are returned? And a suggestion that Martine Batchelor made was that perhaps we can see everything arising conditionally in a less permanent way. We can try to inquire about the conditions that caused this whole interaction. So what does that mean in practice? Okay, when your relative says the manipulative thing, to take this example, can we understand how they came to utter those words? Things that are a part of their history, the things that are part of their nature, things that are part of their environment, the things that conspired to create this moment where they uttered this thing that they said. Doesn't have to be a relative. Insert your favorite aggravating thing that's happened to you. It could be a colleague, a child, it could be your partner, whatever it is. And there's another half to this seeing things arise conditionally and inquiring about the conditions. It's not only about them, it's about us, right? So when these little words land on us, can we understand why we react the way we do? What part of us feels challenged and threatened? When we do this, we can easily, or at least more easily, see how all of this is a bit more impersonal, right? We're just a pair of humans interacting and reacting and responding to everything around them and within them. One of those in the pair is the relative, one of those in the pair is you. And this is just what happens, right? In doing that, maybe we can loosen a little bit the clinging, the aversion. The sense that this is something that has affected our identities. This is something that has challenged who we are. So that's a first reflection, is can we see the impermanence, the arising and falling of causes and conditions that create everything that comes to us and everything that we react to? Maybe especially in those moments after a deep shift, we're able to see those things, and we can preserve that. That's something that we can actively work to keep going in our lives. Second note is that we can observe that everything is a teacher, right? When we come back from these deep shifts, from retreats, whatever it is, this moment in nature, we can see all the challenges, all the return to life, all the return to civilization, the traffic on the ride home from the hike, whatever it is, as teachers, right? It's a lens. It's a choice we can make to view things a different way. When we're in retreat, we get a different kind of teaching. When we're on that hike, we're in relative stillness. We're getting the kinds of lessons we can get in an undisturbed place. By contrast, when we return, there is this whole complementary set of lessons from all the challenges, right? This isn't just, ah, shucks, I have to return from this experience to this difficult humdrum of my daily life. In a way, we could view this differently. This is the complementary and necessary set of lessons that come afterward, right? This is the lessons where the rubber hits the road and we have to actually respond to unpleasant experiences, challenges, the recreation of all the forms and identities. How do we do that? So thinking of this as an opportunity, as a set of teachers, right? That's another perspective we can bring into the world. Can we see the sacred in these interactions? Can we walk through the world? Can the next time we walk to the grocery store, can we see that flower blooming through the concrete as a teacher? The hard conversation with the partner or colleague as a teacher? The bill in the mail that doesn't make any sense and requires that you call customer service. Can that be the teacher? There's a story I want to relate on this too. I used to, before here, I lived in DC. And there was a member of a sangha I attended every Sunday, much like this sangha, who shared a story with all of us about her relationship to traffic in particular. And she was someone who was a very impatient driver at the beginning of her practice. And, she would get frustrated, and DC is quite, if you think Seattle traffic is bad, you should try it there. It's wild and it's unpredictable and people run red lights. There are all kinds of things that go on. She would get very frustrated with the amount of traffic, and in particular, she hated red lights. She just had this relationship where she was trying to time the lights between where she worked and where she lived. And every once in a while, it would just feel unfair that every time she arrived at a light, it would turn red. Ugh. I was supposed to get home at this time. I needed to stop at the grocery store. This is going to delay me a few more minutes. And then the next one turns red. Ugh. This is unfair. These all should not be turning red. What is going on? She would have these feelings about the red lights. And she would sit there waiting at the red lights and feel relieved when it turned green. And she made it a practice to actively change her lens and make the red light her teacher. And she would, over time, you know, by just sort of saying, okay, this is a teacher. I'm feeling all of this resistance. I'm feeling this feeling of unfairness. This shouldn't have been red at this moment. There are all these people in the traffic around me. They're in my way. All of these feelings. And she would work with it as she sat at the red light. And it came to a place where she started to look forward to and love the red lights. She had this transformative experience every time she sat at this red light. She would feel so good about the opportunity to practice at the red light and to change her view of the people around her as instead of obstacles, as being part of the community that she was in at every red light. And the red light as a teacher, an opportunity to sit and be still and practice on her way home from work, like a little mini meditation with a mini sangha around her. And it was just a wonderful and delightful story. I remember it as this, whenever I think of this idea of everything around us being a teacher. A third thing we can do is we can create supports in our life. So for me, this is a personal story. When I went to one of these retreats, that is the kind we're describing in this talk, you know, about these retreats that deeply shifted me. This was about 10 years ago. And I remember the feeling at the end of the retreat where I was like, how am I gonna, I have to go back to my life. I have to go back to all these challenges that were actually the cause of why I wanted to go on retreat to begin with. How, am I gonna be able to preserve this? There was a great fear that this wonderful thing that had happened during this retreat would be harder. And a large part of being able to maintain it, at least to some degree, it's not like I basked in that glow for months and years afterward. You know, I became normal, I got irritated with things, all of that happened again. But I do feel like something important was preserved in that retreat that really hasn't left, even till now. And I think what helped with that was creating supports. For me, before that retreat, I didn't really have a daily practice. And I didn't have a sangha that I felt I could return to. And so I joined that DC sangha, the same one where the red light story came from. I joined that sangha intentionally after the retreat. And I would go at least every Sunday. And eventually it became, you know, that I would go to it. I would meditate every day. And slowly over time, you know, even my friends, the group of people who I wanted to spend time with and the people who I spent less time with, there were subtle shifts in you know, who seemed to me to be people who grew me, who preserved the things I wanted and brought out the best in me, those kinds of things, right? We talk about that often in this practice, you know, wisely choosing the company you keep. Those kinds of support can be really helpful. A fourth thing is really reminding yourself that when we go into the marketplace, I realize I'm still sharing. There's my face. As we go into the marketplace, as this monk has done, you know, we are doing good for not just ourselves, but everyone in our communities. Right. We are connected. The ox herder is engaged. He's mingling with the crowd. In just doing that, he's bringing the quality of his presence into this group. It's like dropping a pebble into a pond and seeing these ripples come out and affect everything around. William Butler Yeats has a quote that I really like to read. I've probably read it before in this group. We can make our minds so like still water that beings gather around us that they may see their own images and so live for a moment with a clearer, perhaps even a fiercer life because of our quiet. So I'll leave with an inquiry. And it's along this engagement, and the value of engagement inquiry. Have you ever had the experience of observing someone else handle a challenging situation with such grace that they inspire you? Maybe even deeper, have you ever been the cause of a challenging situation, or maybe, you know, you were the proximal cause and then you were humbled and inspired by how it was received by the person who addressed it, you addressed it to? It can be very powerful medicine. Really, the inquiry here is, can we be the person who delivers that medicine? So just reminding ourselves of that value to bringing our practice into the world, to bringing it into our daily lives, can be something that aligns us with our values and urges us to do it for reasons other than ourselves. Okay. So I'll summarize kind of the things that I've mentioned very quickly before we break out for groups. So this inquiry of how can we bring the changes at the top of the mountain, whatever those shifting experiences are that we've had, how can we bring them to our daily lives? And the four things that were mentioned, one is to see the causes and conditions and the impermanence behind all the suffering and reactivity in our lives. Another is recognizing that everything can be a teacher. The third is creating supports that preserve those shifts, that allow them to bloom. And the fourth is reminding ourselves how doing so, bringing this into our lives, really is for the greater good. So connecting it to our values. Okay, so we will break out. Thank you. Yeah. So we'll break out into groups now. And in doing that, if you need an inquiry, you can talk about anything in these groups that comes up as a result of the picture or the talk. But if you'd like a specific prompt, it could be, what are your own reflections on how to bring meditation into daily life? You know, have you ever experienced a shift and then worked with how to preserve and nurture that shift after it happened, some kind of profound shift? So I will go through and break us out into groups with who remains. I think that's everyone. Welcome back. So there's some time now for anyone to share anything that's come up, either questions or comments or reflections, anything that came up in your chat groups. Although, do be mindful of preserving any comments that others have made that may have been made in the confidence of your small group. Yeah, and I'm going to put up, so you can either unmute yourself or you can raise your hand. The way to do that, at least on my screen, is to click the reactions button at the bottom of Zoom and then click the raise hand button from there.
Okay.
I can hear someone talking, but I wasn't sure who it was.
I'm sorry. You probably heard me. I was just saying goodbye to Cheryl, who was leaving.
Oh, yeah. Bye, Cheryl.
Well, I know that Julie in our group was in the middle of a great point before we got brought back to the group. I don't know, Julie, you want to be put on the spot to share what you had to say?
Oh, what I was saying was what a gift Arv's sharing about that woman in D.C. with the stoplights is, because that was such a fantastic illustration of what we can do on a daily basis. You know, notice how we're angry or frustrated or we're not living up to who we would prefer ourselves to be. And instead of pushing it away, turn it into a practice. It is so lovely and so powerful. Thank you, Art.
Thanks, Julie. Yeah, I felt the same way when she shared it. It was just such a really, I don't know, very real way
yes.
that we can meet these kinds of challenges. Yeah. Yeah.
What a gift. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. Suze, I saw your hand up and I go down. Was there something you wanted to share?
I realized in my sharing that I think I created like an 11th picture between 9 and 10. I was reflecting on the retreats that I've gone on and when my partner Bill would pick me up. And for the first few years, I would just kind of like dump everything. And it was not very, very skillful. And so I realized that I needed time and space to reflect on what I actually had learned or seen or experienced on retreat, and then figured out what was I going to share and whose benefit was the sharing for? You know, was it just to hear me talk, or was it, you know, how was it going to benefit him, our friendship, our relationship? Was it going to deepen my own understanding? So I realized that over the years, there was a lot of not sharing from the retreat for sometimes days, weeks, months, even years, because I didn't totally understand what the experience was either. So there was like, maybe it was going back to some of the earlier pictures and not really an 11th. Maybe it was just going back to trying to understand, but how we share what we've gained, that was a big piece for me, is the how.
Yeah.
The how and the when. Well, and also the what.
Uh-huh.
How much.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and what not to share, as you're pointing out too, yeah. That's a really great point. Yeah, I've heard this referred to as sort of integration, you know, and I've seen some individuals do this really wise thing where sometimes they take a stepping stone, like a retreat after a retreat for just a day or two to process and to gradually return. And sometimes that processing is kind of, you know, the adjustment period to speaking again and to being part of the world again. But sometimes it's this real reflection that you're mentioning here, where you're deciding, right? What do I want to share? Who's it for? You know, and what maybe isn't worth, what isn't worthy of sharing now? Maybe I need to sit with it more before letting something out. Yeah. Is that what you're saying? Is that, yeah. Yeah. I really love that reflection. It's a great point. It's a great step that we can do with retreats. Yeah. I almost, you know, that almost sounds like good advice to have in, you know, retreat guidelines, you know, so that people can plan ahead and spend a day with integration of this sort. Thank you for sharing that. That sounds like a great tip. Yeah.
To take that one step further, it's also kind of a nice little pause between when somebody says something to you and you respond.
Yeah.
Take that a little extra step.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that pause. Hmm. I'm trying to take that pause now, Jerry. I don't know if you noticed. Yeah, I think that's really important. I think of the quote, between stimulus and response, there is a space. You know, and in that space, I'm going to get it wrong. But it's in that space lies our freedom, right? It lies our choice, our ability.
I will meet you there, I believe. I will meet you there.
Oh, there's that too.
That was part of it on that death.
Oh, I think that's a different one. That's the Rumi quote in the
field. Right. Okay. So.
Yeah. And this one is Victor, someone help me here.
Frankl.
Thank you. Frankl. It's Viktor Frankl. Yeah.
Lillian and Nikhil have their hand up.
Oh, thank you. Lillian and Nikhil, please.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm really thankful for the talk and the reflections in the small group. And as somebody who has yet to go on retreat, I think a lot of this for me is like Sunday sit is where I see the impacts of the practice on my life. And it's almost like you're like running along throughout the week and your health is declining, and then you get to Sunday and your health goes back up and you're like full of health on Monday. And then it just like kind of throughout the week. So I think, yeah, I'm just really grateful for everybody here every week, sharing this and just like all the offerings and everything that's available. So I'm really grateful for the Sangha.
Thank you, Lillian. Thanks for sharing that. And yeah, you named something important. There have been a lot of times in my life when I can't go on retreat. You know, there's just too much. And it doesn't have to be about retreat, right? We have these shifts. So many things can create these shifts, whether it's sitting in Sangha or, you know, just experiencing something in our ordinary lives a different way, right? And that's subtly affecting you, right? And we can have all these processes with it. Like sometimes it affects us and we even forget about it by the end of the day. But we can also nurture those experiences, those everyday experiences, you know, and find, you know, investigate those shifts that we feel when we experience them, and really nurture them. Yeah, thank you for sharing your gratitude with the group too. The group feels the same way. Thank you for being part of it. All right. So I wanted to, I don't see any hands now. So I'll shift now to a few announcements.